This is Crappy to Happy, and I am your host, Cass Dunn. I'm a clinical and coaching psychologist, a mindfulness meditation teacher, and of course, author of the Crappy to Happy books. In this show, I bring you conversations with interesting, inspiring, intelligent people who are experts in their field and who have something of value to share that will help you feel less crappy and more happy. My guest today is Tara Kerwin, who is a marriage and family therapist from the US. Tara, alongside her husband EJ, is co-founder of Relationship Renovation Counseling Center, and together they also host a top-rated podcast called the Relationship Renovation Podcast. Relationships is such a huge topic, and Tara has really walked her talk in this space. Although she has been a licensed therapist since her early 20s, it wasn't until she was in her mid-30s and met her now husband that she realized that she had her own trauma that had been impacting her ability to cultivate really healthy relationships. So together, the two of them recognized that while they were really experts in this space, they each had their own work to do in order to ensure that their relationship survived and thrived. Tara recognized she had a whole lot of past trauma that she thought she had dealt with, but that she hadn't. She has really cultivated a lot of self-awareness, and now they have built a relationship that they can both feel very proud of. But they also have used what they have learned in their personal lives to develop a signature couples therapy program. So in addition to the face-to-face work that they do with people, they also have an online program, which Tara and I will talk about in this episode. We talked about the impact of early attachment wounds, past traumas that impact current relationships, problems that arise when there is a lack of intimacy in a relationship and how you navigate those conversations. We covered so much ground in this. I know it's going to be relevant to so many people. So without further ado, let's jump in. Here's Tara. Tara, welcome to the Crappy to Happy podcast.
So happy to be here. I love the name.
I love the name of your podcast, Relationship Renovation. I bet that gets a whole lot of listeners just because of the title.
Yes, exactly. Like, what does this mean to renovate my relationship? It means many things.
Yeah. So you are a relationship counselor. You're a licensed therapist in the US along with your husband, and yes, you run a relationship counseling center together. I mean, this is a huge topic for any audience, and especially with the podcast Crappy to Happy, you know, relationships are for many people a big source of distress. Broadly, what are the kinds of issues that most people, by the time they get in to see you, what are the kinds of issues that you're seeing day in and day out?
Oh, Cass, how much time do we have? So I would say, unfortunately, like 80% of the couples we see, it is like either this or we're done. So most humans wait until a crisis happens to try to repair it. So unfortunately, like 80% of the couples are already in some kind of crisis mode. And it's infidelity, emotional, wow, physical infidelity. It's poor communication. It's been resentment for 20 years. Intimacy is totally non-existent. You name it, we see it. And my heart wants so badly to do more preventative measures. And we've tried to do like relationship building skills for newly committed couples. Guess what? No, it doesn't work because they're good already. And so I think that people just don't understand once a relationship hits a certain point, there are so many skills needed. And I learned this myself in order to make a relationship last. We can't just keep our fingers crossed that it'll stay that way forever. So unfortunately, yeah, people wait until the last, you know, either the word divorce or we're done or a threat. And then here we are. It's a pretty heightened, anxious place when they come in to see us. And I totally get it because I was right there with them.
Yeah. Do you want to just talk about that maybe? Because you have your own personal story, don't you, of having maybe not the happiest relationships and then having to really do the work yourself.
Darn it. I know. I was like, what? I mean, I've been a marriage and family therapist for 22 years. So I knew when I was a little girl, like I didn't know it was called a couples therapist, but I knew I wanted to help couples because of, I don't know, it was just this, like, when I would see couples in distress, I would cry for them. I just had this empathic ability to, like, feel people's pain and suffering. And being in my own, like, pretty awful, neglectful childhood with a ton of trauma, I knew that I was going to get through it because I had a resilient soul from a young age and that one day I would help others. And so I was a great marriage counselor, yet in my own life, like, yeah, this relationship isn't working. This relationship isn't working. This relationship isn't working. And I didn't realize just how much my trauma, I thought I was just like this really resilient soul. I didn't recognize how much my trauma was impacting my ability to stay in a healthy relationship because I just didn't even know what that was. And so when I met EJ, who of course was another therapist, like it took another therapist. And when I met EJ, he just had this emotional safety to him that I've never had in another relationship. Like he just would go deeper. And I knew that I didn't want to leave him the way I left other relationships. And so, I mean, I was like, okay, I'll marry you. I was 38. I had waited for a really long time. And then, you know, we got married and he had two boys who were 2 and 4 who were delightful. And then on our honeymoon, we get pregnant with twins.
Oh, wow.
So I went from 0 to 4 kids under the age of 5. 6 months later, the twins, by the way, both had colic, like not just for weeks, for 9 months. And so I was like, I'm out of here. I did not sign up for this. What is this awfulness? I mean, I was so stressed, so overwhelmed. Had no idea that twins and colic would, and nursing every hour. And that's when I wanted to leave EJ. I was like, this is too much for me. I'd never been that overwhelmed in my whole life. Mm. And that's when I just called him one day crying. I was like, if the two of us were pretty great people, we've got the skills, we're therapists. If we're having this hard of a time navigating this new transition to blended family and twins, I'm like, we've got to A, figure our shit out. B, we have to help other couples in our community. And that was in 2016. So almost 10 years ago. And now we have a staff of 15 therapists and created this model that has helped couples. We have an at-home program too. So it's actually helped couples worldwide. But it all started with like, I knew I didn't want to leave, but we had to figure out why this was so hard. That was kind of the start of our Relationship Renovation Counseling Center. And we're still together and our twins are 11 and we made it. But it was really, really well hard because what I thought, like I thought EJ and I had the skills. And when our life got stressful, he got defensive and avoidant. I got more anxious and we literally disconnected. We did not know how to figure it out. And I feel like through our own experience and everything we had to do to develop our emotional safety and healthy communication, like that's how we're so, people just really trust us because it's, we had to go through it ourselves. So when couples come in and sit in front of us, we're like, oh yeah, we know. It might not be the same situation, but it's the same feeling alone in it and disconnected. And it looks like you want different things, but actually you want the same thing. You just don't know how to say it. And for us, the intimacy piece was big because after the twins were born, no, like none of my body wanted any of it. I was like a different person.
Yeah. There is so much there to explore.
I know.
I mean, first up to acknowledge that, I mean, one baby is a bomb in a relationship. But twins, I haven't had twins. I've only got one child, but I can only imagine the stress of twins. And then you add somebody else's two kids into your life as well. Like that's a lot. That's a lot for any person to deal with. But what you have highlighted just then is the different ways that you and EJ dealt with how you handle pressure, basically, because of your own early experience.
Yeah.
So is that kind of where you tend to start with couples that come to see you?
Yes. In a nutshell, yes. But you can't go there too soon because you kind of have to peel the layers off a little. Because what the first thing I did I was so overwhelmed and resentful that EJ brought up this stress in my life. I'm like, how dare you? What happened? This is not my stuff. I was so resentful that I couldn't even hear. I did not have compassion for him. I did not want to be vulnerable with him. I was just angry at him at even the sight of him. I was like, ugh. And I had never had that before. And so that's what the couples we see, like they sit on like opposite ends of the sofa. They got the pillows over them.
Yeah.
I know it very well. I need to start getting very small love seats so they can't sit so far apart. So the very first thing I did, and this was before EJ and I even started our couples counseling center, is if I was feeling really resentful of him, I call a code word and I say, EJ, ours was burnt toast. Why? Because I kept forgetting I had toast in the toaster because I was always so dang busy and my coffee would be cold in the microwave. Freaking toast would be burnt. And I just said, EJ, when I say burnt toast, that means I'm not good. I'm not going to say anything that's kind or loving because I'm not in a kind or loving space. And I need to take like my own time out. And so either that's you taking all of the kids and our dogs, just taking them away somewhere in the desert for a hike, or I'm going to go in my room and don't let anybody come in there. Like, I just need to kind of calm my nervous system. And so that was the first thing. I knew I looked at him in resentment, disdain, and I knew that that wasn't my heart, but it was for sure my overwhelm. Like, how dare you make me feel so overwhelmed? That was my story. So then when I started taking the time outs for myself, I went through a little protocol. I don't know if you've ever heard of Tara Brach.
Yeah.
She's like one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. And she has this RAIN protocol.
Yes.
Recognize, allow, investigate, nurture. I would just go in my bedroom and cry. And I would listen to Tara Brach, whatever her latest podcast was, it didn't matter. And I remember she took me through the RAIN technique. It's actually one of the biggest tools for mindfulness that we use at our center for couples. And I would be like, what's happening here? And so I started to understand that my overwhelm was a result from when I was very little, so much trauma, so much abuse. I have a twin sister too. And we both had it pretty bad, but she would be more reactive, where I was like, keep the peace kind of person because I didn't, you know, want my step parents to get crazy. So I would like try to protect my sister all of the time. So just that feeling of like overwhelm and trying to keep us safe, like that was the feeling that EJ triggered in me, but I would never have known that had I not gone deeper. My nervous system doesn't know if it was 35 years ago or today, but it was this feeling of I can't handle this and I'm not safe. EJ just walking in the door could trigger that. So I started to recognize, oh my gosh, I haven't even hit on my trauma. I've just avoided it my whole life and helped others. Awesome. But no. And so that was, so the beginning was code words. So we help couples stop reinforcing their negative. It's traumatic for them. Like, they are not kind to each other. They are not making each other feel wanted. They are not making each other feel like they're in each other's care. That's trauma, right? We all want to feel a sense of belonging. So code word's one of the first things, so they can just have some respite from that. And then we start to help them understand what those negative core beliefs are that are being triggered. For me, mine was, I'm not safe and I'm insignificant. And when our person next to us can hear that it's not that they are not the direct root or cause of that suffering, that actually this started to get developed very early on because we use attachment theory in our practice. They're like, oh my God, I'm not the worst person in the world. Now compassion starts to get built. And now your partner can look at you and say, you are significant. You are safe. I'm so sorry. The behaviors trigger that, but now I have a better understanding. So when both partners have a better understanding, then they can move through the challenges of having a relationship, which there are many, with compassion and empathy and a much broader understanding of like how we are from like young kids to now. Like, we're one person, but you know, when we cause suffering to another, it feels like we're the worst person in the world and we don't have space to see their suffering. But again, that process allows, you know, when I would come to EJ and be like, listen, when you said this, this is what happened. He had no idea that it was triggering some physical abuse from my stepdad or dad.
Yeah.
He was just like, wow, thank you for helping me understand. And I said, it's not about asking you to not do that behavior again, because you will. You will avoid, you will defend yourself, you will walk away. It will drive me crazy. Can't ask you to be this perfect person for me not to trigger my trauma. But if you can have a little bit more understanding and I can do my own work and come back and say how it impacted me, well, now we're moving through it, not pushing it under the rug. And, you know, there's some conversations that are easier than others. You know, intimacy is much harder. That's a more vulnerable conversation. Yeah. But when you get the skills of developing that kind, compassionate communication around each other's suffering, all healing begins right there. And so we have a very high success rate.
That's good. And it's
only because we take them through this process, and it takes about 6 months, but it is, we're not just doing communication. We like look at you from the time you were in your mother's womb until you met this person, and we go through all of it and the layers of it and getting deep within what those negative core beliefs are about yourself. And I think that's why, yeah, even if couples don't stay together, which sometimes that's the case, they have more clarity now, and they did this for their kids, and like now they can be kind co-parents.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That's huge, because we're not like, you have to be together.
Yeah. Like, no, hey, no, of course. But Tara, what you just said there, and you obviously you opened with the fact that EJ is a therapist as well. And so he obviously, while being a therapist, I know as much as anybody, doesn't make you the perfect evolved person. Like, you know, we can know all of this stuff, but still have your own issues and patterns that you fall into. But he obviously was a person who was really, like you said, he was emotionally safe, and he was very available and able to hear that from you.
Yeah.
It sounds like it does really require two people to be involved in this, doesn't it? Because potentially, while you were talking then, I was thinking, I can already imagine in certain relationships with certain individuals, somebody almost weaponizing your trauma, like, ah, see, it is all because you're fucked up. Like, it is all because you're the one with the trauma. You know, like, it's got to be a really safe space for people to be able to be open about, okay, this is my childhood wounds, and this is how it's affecting me in the moment.
And I have goosebumps only because, like, EJ didn't even recognize how much healing he had to do, like his defensiveness. He just thought he was like this mindful Buddhist.
Right.
I was like, oh, no, no, sir. I feel that rage under there. I can feel it. I mean, it took me years for me to always challenge him. Like, honey, there's something else happening here. Trust me. Like, and so he trusted me, right? Gave me the benefit of the doubt that I wasn't saying that to, like, because he was always emotionally available, but he had some stuff that was very stuck to from his past relationship and his, you know, childhoods. But here was the thing, because we're therapists and we do what we do, we were compelled to heal and grow. Most people aren't in this field. They don't start a podcast. It's not as compelling, because I can't be an imposter. I can't have a couples counseling center and have all these couples like do these things and not do them for myself. So like, we were compelled to do the work together, and I get the piece for other couples, they're not. And so one person might be way more proactive than the other. Again, EJ and I were both proactive, I think, because of the types of humans we are, and we really wanted to make this work, and we really wanted to support other couples. But we have many individuals that come in and their partner's just not ready. And we say, listen, it just takes one person to be the change agent in this dynamic. Because if you start having better boundaries, they can't treat you that way anymore, right? Or so we see a ton of individuals at our center too, because not all couples are ready. And yeah, and there are people like we've had to deal with, right? Access to narcissistic qualities, sociopathic. The term gaslighting, please, I don't want to hear it anymore. Like, I'm over it. But it's like, you know, and we can't do there. You have to have some type of shared goal to do the couples work that we offer. And so if we don't, we say, let's do some individual work first. So we know when it's, we do a pretty lengthy consultation process to make sure that couple's ready, and not necessarily like you have to be all in, but just that there is openness to healing suffering in whatever way that looks, because we're all uniquely different.
When couples are in conflict, how does somebody know whether this is my trauma or this is my issue or this relationship's just wrong for me or you're just not the right person for me? How does somebody make that? Because I think people get it in their heads and really struggle to figure that out on their own. Are there signs? Like, are there things that people can explore for themselves or questions they can ask themselves that might help them have a clue about that?
Yes. So I would say, so first of all, you're just like in, you're in this state of ambivalence and do I want to be with this person? Should we be together? The first piece is like, how receptive is your partner, right, to doing some of the work? And let's just say that they're not, but you're recognizing that you're not happy, that you're sad, that you don't have that energetic piece of you anymore. Like, that was me. I just felt overwhelmed and just down and depressed. Like, this isn't me. And it's got to be this person causing it. But I was like, okay, I know, right? As a therapist since I was 22, I cannot have emotion regulation based on external circumstances, that I have to feel safe internally for me, no matter what the external is. And so I would do a lot of internal emotion regulation first to have clarity. So I'm not expecting others to heal my wounds, which I used to do all of the time.
Right.
And I feel like that gave me a sense of empowerment. So then I wasn't ambivalent. It was a lot of my own individual work. And now I have a choice. And then you get to make decisions based on empowerment or choices based on feeling empowered versus ambivalent, which you don't know where to go. And so do you know what it takes? This is the latest research. 7 to 10 years of being in misery to reach out for counseling. Seven to 10 years. Imagine what your little body does. 7 to 10 years of being miserable or ambivalent. You just start to feel, you lose any sense of agency. And then I'm just going to accept it is what it is. So for me, it's very much an individual, like, how do I get more empowered so I can make a choice that feels more clear to me? And then, right, there's tons of books and podcasts, and just the RAIN protocol for me is, I mean, I didn't necessarily, I mean, I still do weekly therapy. I always will. But just having that by myself in the bedroom, listening to Tara Brach's voice, like, that was enough for me to soften inward and be like, okay, like, EJ's not a monster.
Yeah.
But I feel unsafe around him. I don't know. So, and then you want to have a partner that, you know, if you have someone that's consistently not taking any accountability, like, now it's toxic. Now that just doesn't feel good. And I'm like a healer and I'm a people pleaser. So I used to stay in those relationships because I'm like, oh, like, they'll get better. And like, ah, like, I would overfunction at every level. But again, it was once I started to do a lot of the individual work, I just felt really empowered that whatever choice I made, I would be okay no matter what.
It does sound like it all really starts with, like, regardless of your, whatever your personal history is, what you said before about cultivating safety within yourself. Yeah. Not looking outside for somebody else to create that or do whatever it is that you personally feel like you need for them to do. Like, that's a starting point for anybody, isn't it?
Yes, just hard because we like instant gratification and to feel like taken care of by our other person. And so when you have to do that work, it's more delayed gratification, but it's so worth it. It's freedom because, and here's another thing, right? I love statistics. First divorce rate right now is 49.3%. Second time married is 67%. Third marriage is 74%. It follows you. You could marry the exact opposite and your stuff will follow you. So doing the work, regardless of whatever relationship you're in right now, is so worth it. So you don't repeat those steps. You don't repeat those unconscious attachments, shall I say.
We don't get better at marriage the more times we do it.
No. And it's like, I mean, we have people like, I married the exact opposite person. How is this happening again? And then those people feel like they're uniquely broken. I'm like, no, no, look at the statistics. right? You just, you know, we want to run from triggers and we want to be like, no, this is a bad situation. We shouldn't be in it. Now, yes, there are some unsafe situations that you do need to make yourself safe and get out of there. Trust me, we have those too. But like, it is so important to stay with uncomfortable and learn from it. And we have this big chalkboard right when you walk into our lobby and it says, our partner is our greatest teacher. Be patient for the lessons. This is the one person that will trigger all of your shit that you don't even know about. But it's like, you don't want to stay around for it because it's really annoying.
Yeah.
But if you really sit with it, I say, guys, like EJ's my blind spot. He's going to tell me when I can't, you know, see something because I trust that he has the best interest for me. Like he wants me to be happy.
Yeah.
So when we usually kind of say it in that way, it's like, okay, I'm willing to be uncomfortable for like 6 months, you guys. Okay. Might be longer than that, but you never know.
You mentioned that attachment theory informs a lot of the work that you do, which is obviously great. I mean, out there just in general on social media now, there's loads of people who are talking about, oh, I'm an avoidant, or if you're in a relationship with an anxious or this or that, you know, people are talking about attachment out there. There is this kind of preconception, I guess, that if you're avoidant, you're probably going to hook up with somebody who's anxious and that's a disaster.
Yeah.
Is it possible for people who have these attachment styles based on their early history to make it work? Like if they are one of those couples, anxious, avoidant, you're triggering me every time we have a conflict. Is there hope for those people?
It is, like, again, secure attachment, right, is what our hope is for all humans. Secure attachment is I can be me no matter what, and I still am lovable, and I have a sense of belonging. So with all my imperfections, like, we can be each other, whoever that is, all the good, all the bad, and we are still loved. So that is the hope. And the interesting that happens, Cass, is that when we start doing all of this attachment work with couples at an individual level, but they're together, most people have never had any secure attachments ever. So they don't even know what it feels like. So when we start to build, most of our couples leave our center with a secure attachment coming from disorganized, avoidant, anxious, you name it. I've got all of them. I've got the disorganized, I've got the anxious, I've got the, I mean, I don't like to like label one thing, but the idea is that when you're building secure attachment, I can be whoever it is I need to be, and EJ will still love me. And even though when times are hard, there's no threat that he'll leave me because I'm a bad person. Like, we just build this, it's like a trust, right? That should be built between infant and caregiver, right? But if you have an inconsistent caregiver who, let's just say, has a drinking problem or mental health issues, right? You get this inconsistent caring. So that is what develops an insecure attachment, whatever that insecurity is. It could be avoidant, it could be anxious. So when you actually can build trust that no matter what happens, this person will consistently try to meet your needs and love you, it's everything. And you'll see couples hugging in our parking lot. We live near our center. So we're open 7 days a week, and I see couples hugging each other. I was like, oh, that's happening. They're building their secure attachment. Like, it's beautiful to see. And yes, do anxious and avoidant hookups very naturally, for sure. But that just means they have the best ability to trigger each other to then develop the secure attachment. But they look at it in the wrong way. They see this person as the person is the source of their suffering. Why don't you see this person as the source of your growth?
I love that. So what you just said was, if you end up with somebody who really triggers you, you could potentially, you could reframe this to the perfect opportunity for your own growth and healing.
Absolutely. If it's physically safe, right?
Yes.
Emotionally safe. Like, that's the thing. There are some toxic relationships out there, and there are people that, you know, do have malicious intent, unfortunately. So I always just want to say, like, it's, you know,
for sure.
But no, for the most part, if your partner triggers you, Oh my gosh. Like I get so excited when EJ and I trigger each other because we always grow from it. And he still wants to avoid conflict. Like just yesterday, he's like, well, how can we make this better? I'm like, no, but look what just happened. Like I just learned so much about our trigger that just happened while we were barbecuing. And he's like, okay, you're right. Like he still wants to go to the avoidance piece. But I get so excited because we just keep growing from each other. I mean, we still have our arguments. We still have our areas of communication where we can get better. And so when we do have our little fallouts now, do they happen less? Yes. Are they less intense? Yes. Are they less frequent? Yes. But we're still like we learned a huge thing about our relationship yesterday.
So there's opportunities everywhere. If you're open.
You can be okay with being not okay.
The other thing you said earlier, Tara, was that you were always a people pleaser. And so you were the one who would, in relationships, trust that it will get better or try to fix them or try to be the right person for them. What advice do you have for other people who see themselves in that comment?
I love this. And this is actually, like, I feel like I did a podcast episode on this, but it's called the overfunctioner, right?
Right.
Because people pleasers are overfunctioners. They overfunction in the relationships, whether it's with their kids, intimate partners, friends, family, you name it. So an overfunctioner is this. I want them to be happy. I want them to be okay. So I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure everything's good. Well, when I first started learning this term, right after I was overwhelmed with the kids, my therapist was like, oh my God, girl, you overfunction in every role. I'm like, what? What does that mean? I was like getting gifts for EJ's mom on Mother's Day and all the birthdays. And I'm doing all the homework with my stepboys. And I'm like, isn't that just normal? Like, but other people weren't doing it. And they were like, and my therapist was like, no, Tara, like you have to have boundaries for yourself. Like this is not your job. That's not your role. To like make sure everything is always taken care of. And I was like, what? Again, had been learning, I'd been taking care of my sister. Like we started working when we were 8 just to buy food for ourselves. And I would like go mop floors and then I'd go buy us hot dogs at the 7-Eleven. Like I overfunctioned from a young age just to make sure we survived. So that was one thing. But I didn't know that I could let go of that role when I was an adult. So here's what happens. And this is how, because I work with a lot of people pleasers. If I'm going to overfunction, let's just say for my daughter and help her with her math homework and sit beside her and make sure she gets all of the ones correct, she will never learn how to handle it herself. And now I'm being a disservice because I'm actually not helping her grow. And I'm not letting her be uncomfortable. And I'm not letting her figure it out herself. Or with EJ, if I'm like the one constantly getting all of the Mother's Day gifts, birthday gifts, like, dude, that's not my job. I love your mom. But like, if I keep doing that, I'm not going to let you know that's a kind of a responsibility you should have. Like it's, you know what I mean? That's like a small thing. I overfunction in many different ways. I took on all the intimacy guilt, all of it. But the biggest thing here is when you overfunction, you actually... it's an unconscious mistrust that the other person can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship will fall apart, especially in an intimate relationship. I was like, oh my God, if I don't do this, like if I don't buy the groceries, well, everybody will starve. Well, that's not true. I just didn't trust that EJ could do it. So I would do it for him. And now I learned that was an overfunctioning role. And he's awesome at getting groceries when he needs to. He'll mess it up still sometimes, but that's okay. So we have to give each other the chance to like make mistakes and, you know, let go of that control because it's actually freedom now for me. I have so much more space now that I'm not people pleasing or over functioning, though I still have the tendency. I'm aware of what that tendency feels like. It's like and then I'm like, oh no, that's not mine. I can be of support. If you need help, ask me. It's such a huge shift. When I'm doing a lot of my counseling with my individuals, like that's my jam right there. Like working with people pleasers and overfunctioners. And when they realize they don't have to take on so much, it's like, oh my gosh, Tara, I have my space back. I've got my freedom back. I'm like, I know. I didn't even know it was there.
It's uncomfortable though, right? It's for you to have to let go of that control. Like what you said before, it's that staying with that discomfort.
Yeah. It was so hard, but once you see the impact from it and that your children are actually okay and that your husband actually can handle it, you like with each experience, it gets easier and easier. But in the very beginning, like when my therapist said, Tara, you can't sit and do the homework with the kids anymore, I was like, oh God, they're going to fail. Well, guess what? They have maintained their 90s club status in one of the hardest elementary schools in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
I have not sat with them with a homework assignment, and they're in fifth grade. Since third grade, Cass, guess what? Freedom for me at night. I'm watching my reality shows. You guys go do your homework. Love you. It's so nice. But it is hard at first. But then when you see the outcome of it, it's like, okay, awesome. We got this. Yeah. Now, I still did have to do the Mother's Day stuff for EJ. But I get that that's just not his instinct. Like he went to get me a Mother's Day card and forgot his own mom. I was like, honey, like, he's like, Tara, I just don't think of it. And so I'm helping him, but I'm not over functioning, and that there's a difference. Over functioning is like, I have this mistrust. Supporting him is like, oh, that's just not his wheelhouse. Like he would not remember to probably get me a Mother's Day card if I wasn't like, hey, honey, it's Mom's Day tomorrow. Got to go to Walgreens.
And that's the key, right? It's that being able to discern for yourself where the line is, what's motivating this behavior or what's driving it. And that's, I guess, for every individual, they're going to have to figure that bit out for themselves. The thing that you said before that I wanted to pick up on was, okay, so a big issue in couples is no intimacy. And you experienced it. I know so many couples who are there as well. And we'll talk about that as an issue. But what you just said about intimacy guilt, that you carried all of that guilt, is it your experience that that's a kind of a woman thing, that women feel all of the guilt? It's, and is that just a gendered, like an expectation or a stereotype? I'm curious to know in your experience.
From my experience, there are many women that feel the exact same way I do. So I have to think I'm just not alone in this. And I'm just kind of, you know, making this more general.
Mm.
But for men, that friskiness in their body, I call it friskiness. Like it feels like it comes easier. Like even when they're young, like I, you know, when I'm in middle school and stuff, I'm not masturbating and having to like have this release and all of that. I just liked going on dates and, you know, getting taken out and stuff like that. Like my thing has always been more emotional intimacy and stuff like that. But even like after the twins were born, like my sex drive went to nothing. And I had been like more playful and stuff. But what happened is like EJ, he's consistently frisky. Like he could be frisky at 6 a.m., at 3 in the morning. He could make it happen anytime, anywhere. And then I started to say no a lot, or just like avoid it at all cost, or even get in fights on date night because I'd be like, oh God, I don't want to do this. I do all these unconscious things because I would feel bad. Like, oh God, he's going to want it and I don't want it. And I know that I don't want to give in because that's bad. So that's when like guilt started, right? So then I would just start to avoid it. And here's the biggest thing too, like EJ and I didn't talk about it. Well, couples don't talk about it. They will come in and one of their biggest goals is intimacy. And like, when is the last time you guys talked about it? Well, we don't. Why? Because it's just not happening. We just want it to happen. But how are you going to have it impact you? And if you're not talking about it, how are you going to make it different, right? So we started to recognize there's this unrealistic expectation that intimacy will just go back to the way it was in the beginning of the relationship. No, that's not true. Because what happens is the intimacy guilt is a sort of grief. Like I was grieving, but I didn't know that I lost any desire to be frisky and playful with my husband because now I'm keeping these humans alive, feeding them. I'm constantly cleaning and laundry. Like never knew there was so much laundry with four kids. My God.
Yeah, but, it's a lot.
It's a lot. And so I was grieving it, but I didn't know that the guilt was grief. I just saw EJ get more frustrated and then more shut down. And we see this in our couples, right? So then it just becomes a powerless feeling for both. Mm-hmm. One of our two highest podcast episodes are Low Frisky and High Frisky. EJ talks about what it's like to be the high frisky partner in the relationship. I talk what it's about to be the low frisky, the low desire partner. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Both places feel powerless because the low frisky partner holds all the control. I say when, I say if, mm-hmm. right? That's awful. That's like not a great place to be, but the high frisky partner now feels like they have all the control, right? That the low frisky partner has all the control. And now the high frisky, like, oh, I'm just being punished. Mm-hmm. Like it turns into such a toxic, tense energy when both of them are actually feeling powerless in it. They both want to connect, but they don't know how to because they haven't talked about it. And both are grieving. High Frisky's like, God, I miss my partner. I miss touching them. I miss being close to them. I miss that one unique thing I do with them and not anybody else. And the other partner is suffering alone. God, I miss those feelings of desire. Mm-hmm. God, I just miss the feeling of being who I used to be in the body I used to have. And so once we start to process grief with the intimacy, it takes on a whole new outlook because now couples are willing to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Knowing that they're both in a place of powerlessness. But yes, it's usually that the woman feels intimacy guilt. The man feels frustrated that she's punishing him. This is in like, you know, heterosexual relationships.
Yeah.
And then that last thing, we have had couples that haven't had intimacy in 20 years.
Oh my gosh.
20 years. There was one couple that had never had it and they had been married, not even on their honeymoon.
Really?
Yes. So we have seen the gamut of like intimacy issues. And the biggest thing we noticed is they didn't know how to talk about it because it's super vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it's the most raw you could be with anybody. And when we identify it as grief and powerlessness and that both people feel alone in it, then we can start to make some sort of agreement. And we do a ton of safety containers around intimacy for couples in the beginning, because let's just say your husband comes in and smacks your butt immediately, the wife who maybe is a little frisky will be like, freeze, like, oh no, what's happening? So we say, okay, you guys are going to have safety containers. Like butt touching means just that there's no expectation or anything around that. Because you've got to get your nervous system now recognizing that this person is safe and that hand gestures, you know, are safe and that you guys can work within these containers to then go, you know, because a lot of couples hurt each other with intimacy. Like they really do. They weaponize it with each other, you know, and then when there's infidelity, we work with so much infidelity, like whatever, you know, the perpetrator or the person that, you know, had to go through the infidelity on the other hand, like when they're having sex, that's where a lot of flashbacks come back and trauma. Mm. And like, so there's just so much safety containers we put in for intimacy, but they work because you have to do it. It's boundaried.
Yeah. So going back to the couples who are taking infidelity off the table for a minute. So couples who want to get that back, because what you just said was an important point too. It gets to the point in relationships, I've been there in my own relationship, where I almost, you would avoid any kind of, don't even hug me, because in my mind, as soon as you hug me or as soon as I hug you or as soon as I show you any affection, you're going to take that as a sign that it's on. And if it's not on and I'm not interested, then I'm not going to give you any sign. So then there's not just no sex. There's not even, I don't want to be near you or give you any kind of indication, which is just so self-defeating.
Yeah.
So with your couples, is the work to be done in like creating those smaller, you can hug and you can hold hands, but there's no more expectation, and kind of build back to feeling safe just being connected without the sex before you get to that bit?
Everybody is so different, but most couples we've worked with, especially when they're dealing with you know, painful intimacy experiences with each other is you have to have containers and boundaries. Because, like, let's just say, for example, like, this was just an argument EJ and I had, like, when we're not having sex, EJ will point that out, right? Like, oh, it's been a couple weeks. And then I'm like, okay, yeah, here it goes again. Like, oh, there's my guilt. I know what that is. And I'm like, EJ, let me just ask you this. Why is it like when sex isn't happening, you're aware of that, but we haven't had a date night in 2 months? I said, so I've got to let you know what would feel safe to me is I get it. It hasn't happened. Sex, physical sex has not happened in 2 weeks, but we haven't had a date night in over 2 months, whatever it is. And I've got to let you know, like, I need the emotional intimacy. I need date nights with you. Like, I can't just have sex with you at 3 a.m. and not have had. And he's like, you're right, Tara. He's like, we are not cultivating priority of our relationship. And I am just looking at the frequency that we haven't had it in 2 weeks. So it's those kind of conversations where it's like, I'm willing to have this conversation with you, like, that we haven't had sex in 2 weeks. But I also need you to be willing to be like, oh, we also haven't had a date night in 2 months. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not going to be, it's not going to be on me that we just haven't had the sex, the physical act of it. Like, it's other things too. And so having that type of communication with the other person around, like, okay, so let's just say the person who's got higher frisky, their focus is all like always like, oh my gosh, can we have sex? We're going to have sex. We're going to have sex. We can't have sex. Okay, you've got to be able to now generalize that to other areas in order to build safety around it for then the other person to be like, oh my gosh, they are trying in these other ways. Oh, look, they did. We went out to lunch for 2 hours. We prioritized our relationship for these, you know, these days, because that was really important. Mm-hmm. Because it, you come in with just this one, oh, we want to have more sex. We want to feel more connected. Well, maybe one person does, but what does that mean for the other person? So we help them both define what that is for them and then how to get to these kind of agreements that would cultivate the deepest intimacy possible. And everyone's very different. Everyone is very different, right? And it's not about low sex drive and high sex drive, because those, like, even they can change throughout transitions and lifetime. It is about having healthy communication about what it's like if it's not happening, or if it's happening too much, or if, like, we have people that hide in the closet to get undressed into their pajamas because they don't want their partner seeing them and thinking that, like, sex might. Well, no, you have to be able to be like, hey, I just want to let you know I have that urge to go dress in the closet because my anxiety is really high that if I dress, undress in front of you, you're going to immediately want to just have sex. You start with that type of communication. And then once you guys both recognize the anxiety around it, it's right. It feels unstuck. And, like, yeah, you want intimacy to feel free and flowing and beautiful. And couples have just made it into this big, trust me, we've been there, this big old black cloud. And you're just like, no, it feels good. It's the most connected you could be with somebody. How do we get it back where there's not all this pain attached to it? And it's just by talking about what the feelings are around it, because then it doesn't get held as grief and loneliness and suffering individually.
And as much as you said right at the beginning, like, couples counseling is not, it's not all about just communication, because there's all this deeper stuff that has to be explored. Like, at the end of the day, there is stuff that needs to be communicated, isn't there? There's a lot of conversations in couples that are just not happening. People just don't want to cause a conflict, or they don't want, or they don't know how to say what they want to say.
And it's, I mean, oh my gosh, it's so skills based. When do we learn? When do we learn to talk about intimacy and emotional intimacy? Like, when we're in high school and we're learning about that, we just learn, like, sex, either do it or don't. Don't, and then, like, don't do it. But then when you're in love, do it. So now you're like, wait a second, I have this, like, shameful thing about sex is bad, but when you love someone now, it's good. Like, what? Mm-hmm. No one talks about the skills of what it takes to have a healthy, vibrant sex life, emotional intimacy, connected relationship. And so when couples are like, oh my God, we have to plan our intimacy. Yeah, You do. You have to plan and you have to build skills to really have healthy communication. And it's okay, because guess what? Nothing's working for you now. So just try this. Hmm. I mean, and that's why, like, when I'm in session with a couple, I will have, like, you know, I'll move into the chair across and I'll say, you have to repeat after me. I know it sounds clunky. Well, I hear that that felt really hard for you. Because, right, they're so used to defending themselves and they don't want to hear their partner's pain, and so they can't validate. And I will do it 10 times until they get that feeling of what it means to validate. I hear that that was really hard, because they won't do it otherwise. Yeah. So it's that coaching piece. It's a skill. And I said, see, I know it sounds clunky and you have to repeat after me, and it's almost like a coaching session, but that's okay. Because in the moment when you're not here in this session and you're at home and your partner is coming to you and they are in pain, instead of you being like, well, I'm in pain too, you're going to, wow, is there anything I can do right now to support you? You'll still be able to come back to you, don't worry. But you're going to have that validation piece first, where they feel heard and seen. It's just, we don't have the skill to do it. Hmm. If there is something uncomfortable, we try to defend it. No, that's not true. That's not what I said. You are totally wrong. It doesn't matter. You say, wow, I hear that that was really painful for you. I'm so sorry. What just happened? That is not a skill humans have.
No.
But it is a skill we can build along with empathy and compassion. And when couples really get that and they stop digging their heels in, that it's just going to be some miraculous, awesome relationship forever with hot sex all the time. Like, no, not happening, or there would not be this high of a divorce rate. There's something else happening here.
Yeah.
And that's it. People don't want to. They don't want to learn the skills. They want to think it just organic. But then you ask the question, well, where did I learn healthy communication? How do I go deeper with my partner? What is emotional intimacy and physical intimacy? Yeah, we don't know.
I imagine that is much easier to have those conversations with somebody skilled in the room. I mean, I know that you have your online program that you sell on your website that people can sign up, and it's self-paced. What's the feedback that you get on that for people being able to take that and do it themselves without having somebody in the room to help?
So this is really difficult and hard for some couples. It's pretty, like, we have our videos and everything for the online. There are some couples that need the third person in the room. That's just going to be the objective. So people have reached out all over, like, do you and EJ, can you coach us through? Because the intimacy series, we have it where it's like the communication series is first and then the intimacy series, and you will see people fall off right in the first intimacy exercise. So we opened the second company where our studio is, so we can start doing global coaching because people are asking for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, so for couples now, I say, listen, go talk about this piece, like go get a couples therapist, go talk about this piece, what's happening, what's triggering, why you feel like it's really hard. You know, and we will start offering coaching sessions down the road. But if you get stuck in it and you feel like you can't move through it, that's a very good sign that you just need someone else in that room or remotely. There's great relationship coaches online, to help you through it. But there, I would say we're really good at saying, listen, this, if you are in a lot of pain with your partner, like, this could actually cause more harm than good.
Right.
Because you don't have that person helping. Right, coach exactly how to feel in window of tolerance and emotion regulation. But there's some couples that just do it because they love it. Like the premarital, we have more couples in the premarital, like, oh, we just want to do this to know all about each other. You know, we tried to make it super affordable because that was my heart. It started over COVID and then it just grew into this at-home piece. But yeah, I would just say, I think couples know if there's that hard, like, feeling of tension, resentment, disdain, dislike, that's like a good sign that you might need someone to really help soften those edges first, whether that's individually or a relationship coach.
Yeah. And before you go, Tara, so you talked about starting off with a safe word, and we've talked about, you know, attachment and how that plays out and your triggers and cultivating your own practices of self-compassion, internal safety, all of that. I'm curious to know, so in your online program or in your kind of typical, every couple's different, I know, but in a typical couples counseling process, like what are the kind of key pillars? Like what are the key things that you're going, yeah, you said safe word, for example, but are there sort of key skills or milestones or pillars that are that everybody kind of goes through that are sort of the essential processes that people need to learn?
Well, we call it the shift. Oh my God, that's such a big question. I could like say.
Sorry, that's huge. I should have started with that.
Here's like what our couples go through. And I feel like it could be that's so we developed a model that's beginning, middle, and end, right? Beginning is like, okay, we are out of our window of tolerance. We are fighting. It is awful. We hate each other. We can't talk to each other. Everything feels tense, right? So we start with like helping them understand who they are at a core level, what's happening for them, what are the triggers from each other. That's where we kind of go into attachment theory. We do the whole genogram with them, timeline, birth until they meet, right? Then we're like, okay, oh my God. So you used to hide in the closet when you hear mom and dad fighting. Okay, why? What would happen for you? I would get really scared, right? So we just get to see them as little humans from up until they met. Then we go through their relationship timeline. First date up until now. And we start to identify all the crevices. Oh, yeah, that was a big thing that happened. Oh, and you guys never talked about it before. Okay. So you just waited and you thought by putting it under the rug that it would just be... have resolution. Okay, well, we know that doesn't work. So we help them identify early on what skills they didn't have. And that's why infidelity happened, or that's why, you know, a ton of negative patterns in the communication happened. So once we get to that, that's like the middle. There's this thing that happens and it's called the messy middle. And it's like couples are like, we're not coming back ever. I'm like, oh, you guys, I even have a paper on this because I remind them in the very first session, there will be a part where you don't want to come back. That is the point of change. And I'm going to remind you of it, even if it's in an email, because you cancel your session. So messy middle means this, their dynamic is starting to shift. Even if they've been in dysfunction for 20 years and it feels awful, we don't like change. No. We want things to stay the same, homeostasis, right? Well, homeostasis is getting disruptive because now people are caring more and now they're more aware and it feels really bad. Let's just go back. I don't want to do this anymore. Usually takes 1 to 2 weeks of a little destabilization in the middle. And then the shift happens. We call it the shift. I even have it a podcast called The Shift, where it's like we got into a fight and instead of 24 hours of being apart, we were only apart for 3 hours. And we're like, really? How come? Well, now because there's this understanding and we're repairing it more quickly and we understand each other better. We literally call it the shift and we measure it with intensity, frequency, duration. And the shift is like, we can be together in difficult times and we're not using the threat of divorce or really mean things to say to each other. So that's the shift. And it, again, it's intensity, frequency, duration. Couples are noticing it's less frequent, it's less intense, it's less often. And then you start to notice that our final part is new story, old story. They are now acting in the relationship from their positive core beliefs. I am safe. I am okay. We can handle this versus I'm not okay. I'm not safe. We can't handle this. We're broken. There's something wrong with me. Well, now they are reinforcing their positive core beliefs individually and as a couple's dynamic. And that's like when we're sitting in there, it's usually about 4 to 6 months and we're like, oh, there's nothing really to talk about, right? We know old story, new story is happening. And that, hey, you guys are still going to have road bumps, like, but you have learned how to navigate difficult times together. You've learned how to remove yourself if you are out of your window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. You've learned how to set boundaries with each other and agreements that you will be okay even when you're not okay. You have learned to love different parts of each other that you didn't even know were there. Like EJ's part of avoidance, I'm like, I hate you. And now I'm like, oh my God, that's his little wounded part from when he was like 9. I love that part, even though it's super annoying.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know that's like a long answer to your question, but no, it's such a process, Cass, but you see it in all the stages now that we've done it for so long. It's like, and every couple's different, but you can pinpoint it. Like now that we have all of our, these other therapists trained in our model, they're like, oh my gosh, the messy middle's happening. I'm like, I know. We didn't even know it was a thing until like 2 years in. I'm like, EJ, why after session 10 do people want to leave? Like, and we just started to do all the research around what's happening there. Like we've learned through this whole process too. And it keeps getting better. And now I'm revising everything. Now I'm like, it's just crazy. I keep wanting it to get even more better and better, better, better.
That's so natural though, because it's constantly evolving and growing and you're learning from experience. And I just wanted to ask you too, Tara, I know I said that was the last question, but while you were talking then, I was thinking, so essentially for people who are like listening to this and they've got their own relationship issues, it sounds like whatever people show up with, like it's, he's got a gambling problem. He gambled all our money. He works all weekend. He's never home. He yells at the kids. He's not the kind of parent that I want for our, and he doesn't listen to anything I say. Like whatever the problem is that they show up with, essentially the process is pretty much the same. It's working out what causes that behavior. What's driving the gambling or the working late or the avoiding or the flirting with other women or whatever the thing is, right? It's getting underneath to what's driving that.
Yes. And I love that you said behavior, because we see our person as the source of this suffering. It's actually a behavior that they're doing, but it's not them, you know? So I love that we can start to see people as whole humans that are imperfect, that have behaviors that are definitely not cool at times.
Mm-hmm.
But if they have that willingness to be like, you know what, that behavior is just not working for me anymore, I'm willing to look at this, right, in a realistic way. I mean, it's, again, secure attachment, Cass. Like,
yes.
I can be who I am, even though there's parts of me that are super broken or have had bad behaviors in the past, but like I'm still loved. You know, and it's huge too, like the infidelity piece and the amount of like sex addicts that we've worked with.
Really?
Like knowing that their partners now can accept the part of them that was an addict at that time is so beautiful.
That's like huge.
The healing is just incredible. We have had couples that have gone through infidelity on our podcast, but like more so and more so because couples realize that there is healing to it. Like 70%, look, here's me and my stats. 70% of couples who go to counseling after infidelity actually make it work. But you would normally think, oh, if that happens, we're done.
Yeah.
You know, but 70% of couples who go for counseling with infidelity actually turn out to be stronger and even more deeply connected than they ever thought they could be. Just putting it out there, because that's the thing. Like when it gets to that point, something is really wrong, and now we're acting out of secrecy or whatever it might be.
Yeah,
doesn't feel good.
I think people can take a lot of hope from that from the worst, from the crisis, can come the growth, can come all of the healing, and it could be better than ever.
Yeah.
This has been such a great conversation, Tara. I mean, I could keep you here for 3 hours, but nobody's got the time for that. but thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
I loved it when you were like kind of going through everything we talked about. I'm like, oh my gosh, we did go through a lot.
Crabby to Happy is created and produced by me, Cass Dunn. If you enjoy the show, please hit the follow button wherever you listen to ensure you never miss an episode. Share with a friend to get me into the ears of more lovely listeners, and I would love for you to leave a 5-star rating and review. Thank you so much for being here, and I cannot wait to catch you next week for another fabulous episode of Crabby to Happy.